But Actor Mann made his home in Stockholm in Sweden. Now, because of my mother's people, they resided in that city. When 7 years old, I began going with my father on his fishing trips along the Scandinavian coast. Early in life, I displayed an aptitude for books. And at the age of 9 years, I was placed in a private school in Stockholm, remaining there until I was 14. Now, after this, I made regular fishing trips with my father and wanted to go on all of his fishing voyages. My father was a full 6'3" in height, and he weighed over 190 pounds. So he was a good-sized man, and he was very physical, and that is just exactly how his son, Olaf, turned out. Now, I was 19 in my 19th year when we started on what proved to be our last trip into the sea as fishermen, which resulted in the strange story which shall be given to the world, but not until I finish my earthly pilgrimage, meaning that I will only let this be released on my deathbed. I dare not allow the facts as I know them to be published while I am living, for fear of retaliation or further humiliation, confinement, and suffering that I have endured. First of all, when I returned and told the story, I was put in irons by the captain of the whaling vessel that rescued me. I thought it was crazy, for no other reason than I had told the truth about the marvelous discoveries made by my father and myself. But this was far from being the end of my tortures with society for telling the truth about my adventure. After 4 years and 8 months in absence, I reached Stockholm only to find my mother had died the previous year and the property left by my parents in the possession of my mother's people. But it was at once returned and made over to me. All might have been well had I erased from my memory the story of my father's and myself's adventure and the memory of my father's terrible death. Finally, after all of these hardships, after 4 years of being confined in a mental institution, I dared to tell my uncle this story in detail. He was a man of considerable property and urged him to fit out an expedition for me to make another voyage to the strange land. At first, I thought he favored my project. He seemed interested, and he invited me to go before certain officials and explain to them, as I had to him, the story of our travels and discoveries. Imagine my disappointment and horror when, upon the conclusion of my narrative, certain papers were signed by my uncle, and without warning or my consent, I found myself arrested and hurried away to dismal and fearful confinement in a madhouse where I remained for 28 years. Long, tedious, frightful years of suffering, only because I told the truth, and I never ceased to assert my sanity and to protest against the injustice of my confinement. Finally, on the 17th of October in 1862, I was released. My uncle had died, and the friends of my youth were now strangers indeed. I was a man over 50 years old, whose only known record is that of a madman. I had no friends. I had no money. My property had been confiscated by my uncle. I was at a loss to know what to do for a living. But instinctively, I turned toward the harbor where the fishing boats were there in great numbers. They were anchored, and within a week, I had shipped with a fisherman by the name of Jens Hansen, who was starting on a long fishing cruise to the Lofoten Islands. Here my early years of training proved to be the greatest advantage, especially enabling me to make myself useful. This was all but the beginning of other trips, and my frugal economy, I was in a few years able to own a fishing rig of my own. And for 27 years thereafter, I followed the sea as a fisherman. 5 years of working for others, and the last 22 working for myself. And during all these years, I was a most diligent student of books, as well as a hard worker at my business. But I took great care not to ever mention to anybody again the story concerning the discoveries made by my father and myself. Even at this late day, I would be fearful of having anyone see or know the things that I am writing, and the records and the maps that I have in my keeping. And when my days on earth are finished, I shall leave maps and records that will enlighten and, I hope, benefit mankind. The memory of my long confinement with maniacs and all of the horrible anguish and suffering are too vivid to warrant my taking further chances after over 25 years of confinement. In 1889, I sold out my fishing boats and found that I had accumulated quite a sufficient fortune to keep me the remainder of my life. I then came to America, and for a dozen years my home was in Illinois near Batavia, where I gathered most of the books in my present library, though I bought many choice volumes from my home in Stockholm. Later, I moved to Los Angeles, arriving there on March the 4th in 1901, the date I well remember as it was President McKinley's second inauguration day. I bought this humble home and determined here in the privacy of my own abode, sheltered by my own vine and fig tree, and with my books about me to make maps and drawings of the new lands that we had discovered. Also to write the story in detail from the time my father and I left Stockholm until the tragic event that parted us in the Arctic Ocean. I will remember that we left Stockholm in our fishing boat on the third day of April in 1829. We sailed to the southward, leaving Gotland Island to the left and Olean Island to the right. A few days later, we succeeded in doubling the San Omar Point and made our way through the sound which separates Denmark from the Scandinavian coast. In due time, we put in at the town of Kristiansand, where we rested for 2 days, and then we started around the Scandinavian coast to the westward, bound for the Lofoten Islands. My father was in extremely high spirits because of the excellent and gratifying returns that he had received from our last catch by marketing in Stockholm. and instead of sailing at one of the seafaring towns along the Scandinavian coast, he was especially pleased with the sale of some ivory tusk that he had found on the west coast of France Joseph Land during one of his northern cruises the previous year. And he expressed the hope that this time we might again be fortunate enough to load our little fishing boat with ivory instead of cod or herring or mackerel or salmon. We put in at Hammerfest, latitude 71 degrees and 40 minutes, and a few days of rest. We remained there for 1 week, laying in an extra supply of provisions and several casks of drinking water, and then we sailed toward Spitsbergen. For the first few days, we had an open sea and favoring wind. And when we encountered much ice and many icebergs, a vessel larger than our little fishing scoop would have not possibly threaded its way along the labyrinth of icebergs, or as we squeezed through the barely open channels, these monster bergs presented an endless succession of crystal palaces, of fantastic mountain ranges, grim and sentinel-like, immovable as some towering cliff of solid rock, standing silent as a sphinx, resisting the restless waves of a fretful sea. And after many narrow escapes, we arrived at Spitsbergen on the 23rd of June and anchored at Wiljade Bay for a short time, where we were quite successful in our catches. We then lifted anchor and sailed through the Himalayan Strait and coasted along the North Eastland. It will be remembered that Andre started on his fatal balloon voyage from the northwest coast of Spitsbergen. A strong wind came up from the southwest, and my father said that we had better take advantage of it by trying to reach Franz Josef Land, where the year before we had by accident found the ivory tusk that had bought him such a good price at Stockholm. Never, before or since, have I seen so many seafowl. They were so numerous that they hid the rocks of the coastline and darkened the sky. For several days, we sailed along the rocky coast of Franz Josef Land, and finally a favoring wind came up that enabled us to make the west coast. And after sailing for 24 hours, we came to a beautiful inlet. One could hardly believe it was the Northland. The place was green with growing vegetation, and while the area did not comprise much more than 1 or 2 acres, yet the air was warm and tranquil, and it seemed to be at the point where the Gulf Stream's influence was most keenly felt. Now, on the east coast, there were numerous icebergs, yet we were in open water. And far to the west of us, however, there were ice packs, and still further to the westward, the ice appeared like ranges of low hills. And in front of us, and directly to the north, lay the open sea. My father was an ardent believer in Odin and Thor, and had frequently told me that there were gods who came far beyond the north wind. That was a tradition, my father explained, that still farther north was a land more beautiful than any that mortal man had ever known, and it was inhabited by the Chosen. My youthful imagination was fired by the ardor, zeal, and religious fervor of my good father, and I exclaimed, "Why not sail to this open, godly land? The sky is fair, the wind is favorable, and the sea is open." And even now I can see the expression of pleasurable surprise on his countenance as he turned toward me and asked, "My son, are you willing to go with me and explore? To go far beyond where man has ever ventured?" And I answered in the affirmative. "Very well," he replied. "May the god Odin protect us." And quickly adjusting the sails, he glanced at our compass, turned the prow in due northerly direction through an open channel, and we began our voyage. The sun was low on the horizon, as it was still early summer. Indeed, we had almost 4 months of day ahead of us before the frozen night could come again. Our little fishing boat sprang forward as if eager to please us before the adventure, and within 36 hours, we were out of sight of the highest point of the coastline of Franz Josef Land. We seemed to be in a strong current running north by northeast, and far to the right and to the left of us were the icebergs, but our little fishing boat bore down on the narrows and passed through channels and out into the open sea. Our craft, being other than small, we never could have gotten through these narrow channels. But on the third day, we came to an island. Its shores were washed by an open sea. My father determined to land and explore for a day. This new land was destitute of timber, but we found a large accumulation of driftwood on the northern shore, and some of the tree trunks were 40 feet long and 2 feet in diameter. After one day's exploration on the coastline of this island, we lifted anchor and turned our prow to the north in an open sea. I remember that neither my father nor myself had tasted food for almost 30 hours. Perhaps this was because of the tension of the excitement about our strange voyage in waters farther north. My father said that anyone that had never been this far that he knew of before, and active mentally, had dulled the demands of our physical needs, and we weren't even hungry. Instead of the cold being intense, as we had anticipated, it was really warmer and more pleasant than it had been while we were in Hammerfest on the north coast of Norway some 6 weeks earlier. We both frankly admitted that we were very hungry, and forthwith I prepared a substantial meal for our well-stored cabin. When we were partaking heartily of the repast, I told my father I believed that I would sleep, as I was beginning to feel quite drowsy. "Very well," he said, "I will keep watch." I have no way to determine how long I slept. I only know that I was rudely awakened by a terrible commotion of our boat. And to my surprise, I found my father sleeping soundly. And I cried out lustily to him and started up, and he sprang quickly to his feet. Indeed, had he not instantly clutched the rail, he would have certainly been thrown into the waves. A furious snowstorm was raging. The wind was directly astern, driving our little boat at a terrific speed, and was threatening every moment to capsize us. And there was no time to lose. The sails had to be lowered immediately. Our boat was in convulsions. A few icebergs that we knew that were either on either side of us. Fortunately, the channel was open directly to the north, but would it remain so? In front of us, girding the horizon from left to right, was a vapish fog or a mist, and it was black as the Egyptian night at the water's edge and white like a steam cloud toward the top, which was finally lost to view as it bended with the great white flakes of fallen snow. Whether it covered a treacherous iceberg or some other hidden obstacle against which our little boat would dash and send us to the watery grave, or was it merely the phenomenon of an Arctic fog. There was no way to determine by what miracle that we escaped being dashed to utter destruction. I do not know. I remember that our little boat creaked and groaned as its joints were breaking against the mighty wind, and the rocket and staggered to and fro as it clutched by some fierce undertow of whirlpool and current. Fortunately, our compass had been fastened with long screws to a crossbeam. Most of our provisions, however, were tumbled out and swept away from the deck of a cuddy, and we had not taken the precaution at the time to tie ourselves firmly to the mast of the scoop, we should have been swept out also into the lashing sea. Now, above the deafening tumult of the raging waves, I heard my father's voice. "Be courageous, my son," he shouted. "Odin, the great god, is the god of the waters, the companion of the brave, and he is with us. Fear not." To me, it seemed that there was no possibility of our escaping a horrible death. The little boat was shipping water. The snow was falling so fast as to be blinding, and the waves were tumbling over our counters in reckless white spray fury. There was no telling what instant we would be dashed against some drifting ice pack, and the tremendous swells would heave us to the very peaks of the mountains, when plunge us down into the depths of the sea's trough as if our fishing boat was a fragile shell. For gigantic white-capped waves, like veritable walls, fenced us in fore and off. This terrible, nerve-wracking ordeal, with its nameless horrors of suspense and agony and fear of indescribable conditions, continued for more than 3 hours, and all the time we were being driven forward at fierce speed. And then suddenly, as if a growing weary of its frantic exertions, the wind began to lessen its fury and by degrees to die down. At last, we found ourselves in a perfect calm. The fog had also disappeared, and before us lay an iceless channel, perhaps 10 or 15 miles wide, with a few icebergs far away to our right and an intermittent series of smaller icebergs to the left. I watched my father closely, determined to remain silent until he spoke, and presently untied the rope from his waist, and without saying a word, began working the pumps, which fortunately were not damaged. Relieving the boat of the water that it had shipped in the madness of the storm, he put the boat's sails as calmly as if casting a fishing net, and then remarked that we were ready for a favoring wind when it came. His courage and persistence was truly remarkable, and I admired my father so much. On investigation, we found less than one-third of our provisions remaining, while to utter dismay, we discovered that our water cask had been swept overboard during the violent plunging of our boat. Two of our water casks were in the main hold. Both were empty. We had a fair supply of food, but no fresh water. And I realized that was the awfulness of our position. Presently, I was seized with a consuming thirst. "It is indeed bad," remarked my father. "However, let us try a bed ragged clothing, for we are soaked to the skin. Trust in our God, my son. Do not give up hope." The sun was beating down slantingly, and as we were in a southern latitude instead of the far northland, it was swinging around its orbit, ever visible and rising higher and higher each day, and frequently mist-covered, yet always peering through the lacework of clouds like some fretful eye of fate, guarding the mysterious northland and jealously watching the pranks of man. For far to our right, the rays of deafening the prisms of icebergs were absolutely gorgeous. The reflections emitted flashes of garnet, of diamond, of sapphire, a panorama of countless colors and shapes, while below we could see the green-tinted sea and above the purple sky. I tried to forget my thirst by busying myself with bringing up some food and an empty vessel from the home. Reaching over the side rail, I filled the vessel with water for the purpose of lathering my hands and face. And to my astonishment, when the water came in contact with my lips, I could taste no salt. I was startled by the discovery. "Father," I fairly gasped, "the water, it's fresh." "What, Olive?" exclaimed my father, glancing hastily around. "Surely you must be mistaken. There is no land. You're going mad." "But taste it," I insisted. And after this, we made the discovery that the water was indeed fresh. Absolutely so, without the least grimy taste or even the suspicion of a salty flavor. We forthwith filled our two remaining water casks, and my father declared that it was a heavenly dispensation of mercy from the great gods of Odin and Thor. We were almost beside ourselves with joy, but hunger bade us end our enforced fast, for now we had fresh water in the open sea that we might not expect in this strange latitude where the ship had never been before sailed and the splash of an oar had never been heard. We had scarcely appeased our hunger when a breeze began filling the idle sails, and glancing at our compass, we found the northern point pressing hard against the glass. In response, to my surprise, my father said, "I've heard of this before. It's what they call the dipping of the needle." We loosened the compass and turned it at right angles with the surface of the sea before its point could free itself from the glass and point accordingly to unmolested attraction. It shifted uneasily and seemed as unsteadily as a drunken man, but finally pointed a course. Before this, we thought the wind was carrying us north by northwest, but with the needle free, we discovered it could be relied upon that we were sailing slightly north by northeast. Of course, however, was ever tending northward. Our course was ever tending northward. The sea was smooth, with hardly a choppy wave, and the wind brisk was accelerating. The sun's rays, while striking us aslant, furnished a tranquil warmth, and thus time wore on day after day, and we found upon the record in our logbook that we had been sailing 11 days since the storm had ended in the open sea. By strictest economy, our food was holding out fairly well, but beginning to run low. In the meantime, one of our casks of water had been exhausted, and my father said, "We will fill it again." But to our dismay, we found that the water was now as salt as in the region of the Lofoten Islands off the coast of Norway. This necessitated our being extremely careful of the remaining cask of water that we had. And I found myself wanting to sleep much of the time. Whether it was from the effect of the exciting experience of sailing unknown waters or the relaxation from the awful excitement incident of our adventure in a storm of sea, or due to want of food, I can't say. I frequently lay down in the bunker of our little boat and looked far into the blue dome of the sky. Notwithstanding, the sun was shining in the east, and I always saw a single star overhead. And for several days, when I looked for this star, it was always there directly above us. It was now, according to our reckoning, about the 1st of August. The sun was high in the heavens and was so bright that I could no longer see the one lone star that attracted my attention a few days earlier. One day, about this time, my father startled me by calling my attention to a sight far in front of us, almost on the horizon. "It is a mock sun," explained my father. I have read of them. It is called a reflection or a mirage. It will soon pass away. But this dull red false sun, as we supposed it to be, did not pass away for several hours. And while we were unconscious of its emitting any rays of light, still there was no time thereafter when we could not sweep the horizon in front and locate the illumination of the so-called false sun, as my father had thought it to be. And during a period of at least 12 hours out of every 24, we could see this sun. Clouds and mist would come at times almost, but never entirely. It would never hide its location. Gradually, it seemed to climb higher in the horizon of the uncertain purple sky as we advanced, and it could hardly be said to resemble the sun except in its circular shape. And when not obscured by clouds or the ocean mist, it had a hazy red, bronzed appearance, which would change to a white-like luminous cloud as if it were reflecting some greater light beyond. We finally agreed in our discussion of this smoky furnace-colored sun that whatever the cause of this phenomenon, it was not a reflection of the sun, but some kind of planet of sort. One day, after this, I felt exceedingly drowsy and fell into a sound sleep. But it seemed it was almost immediately aroused by my father's vigorous shaking of me by the shoulder and saying, "Aloft, waken, there is land in sight." I sprang to my feet, and oh, joy unspeakable. There in the distance, yet directly in our path, were lands jutting boldly into the sea. The shoreline stretched far away to the right of us as far as the eye could see. And all along the sandy beach were waves breaking into choppy foam, receding and then going forward again, ever chanting in monotonous thunder tones the song of the deep. The banks were covered with trees and vegetation. I cannot express my feeling of joy at this discovery. My father stood motionless with his hand on the tiller, looking straight ahead, pointing out his heart in thankful prayer and thanksgiving to our god Odin. In the meantime, a net which we found in the stowage had been cast, and we caught a few fish that maturely added to our dwindling stock of provisions. The compass, which we had fastened back in its place in fear of another storm, was still pointing due north and moving on its pivot, just as it had done in Stockholm. The dipping of the needle had ceased. What could this mean? Then, too, our many days of sailing had certainly carried us past the North Pole, and yet the needle continued to point north. We were sort of perplexed, for surely our direction now was south. We sailed for 3 days along the shoreline and then came to the mouth of a fjord, or a river of immense size. It seemed more like a great bay, and into this we turned our fishing craft, the direction being slightly northeast by south of south, but the assistance of a fretful wind that came out to aid about 12 hours out of every 24, and we continued to make our way inland into what afterward proved to be a mighty river, which we learned was called by the inhabitants Hadithiel. We continued our journey for 10 days thereafter and found that we had fortunately obtained a distant inland where the ocean tides no longer affected the water, which again, to our amazement, had become fresh. The discovery came none too soon for a remaining cask of water. We lost no time in replenishing our cask and continued to sail farther up the river because the wind was favorable. Along the banks were great forests, miles of extent could be seen stretching away on the shoreline. The trees were of enormous size. We landed after anchor near a sandy beach and waded ashore, and were rewarded by finding a a quantity of nuts that were very palatable and satisfying to hunger, and a welcome change from the monotony of our stock of provisions. We judged it to be around the 1st of September, over 5 months, we calculated, since our leaving Stockholm. Suddenly, we were frightened, almost out of our wits, by hearing in the far distance the singing of people. And very soon, thereafter, we discovered a huge ship gliding down the river directly toward us. Those aboard were singing in mighty choruses that, echoing from bank to bank, sounded like a thousand voices, filling the whole universe with quivering melody. The accompaniment was played on stringed instruments, not unlike a harps. It was a larger ship than any that we had ever seen, and was differently constructed. At this particular time, our boat was becalmed, and not far from the shore, the bank of the river, covered with mammoth trees, rose up several hundred feet in beautiful fashion. We seemed to be on the edge of some primeval forest that doubtless stretched far inland. The immense craft paused, and almost immediately a boat was lowered, and six men of gigantic stature rowed toward our little fishing vessel. They spoke to us in a strange language. We knew from their manner, however, that they were not unfriendly. They talked a great deal among themselves, and one of them laughed immoderately, as though in finding us a queer discovery had been made. And one of them spied our compass, and it seemed to interest them more than any other part of our ship. Finally, the leader motioned as to ask whether we were willing to leave our craft and go on board their ship. "What say you, my son?" asked my father. "They cannot do any more to us than kill us." "Well, they seem to be kind," I replied, "although what terrible giants! They must be the select six of the kingdom's crack regiment. Just look at their great size. We may as well go along willingly, as basically we would be taken by force," said my father, smiling, "for they are certainly able to capture us." And thereupon he made known by signs that we were ready to accompany them. Within a few minutes, we were on board the ship, and half an hour later, our little fishing craft had been lifted boldly out of the water by a strange sort of hook and tackle, and set on board as a curiosity. There were several hundred people on board with us. It was a mammoth ship, which we discovered was called the Nanth, meaning, as we afterward learned, pleasure, or to give a proper interpretation, pleasure excursion ship. If my father and I were curiously observing by the ship's occupants, this strange race of giants offered us an equal amount of wonderment. Oh my. There was not a single man on board that would have not measured fully 12 feet in height. They all had full beards, not particularly long, but seemingly short-cropped. They had mild and beautiful faces, exceedingly fair, with ruddy complexion. The hair and the beard of some were black. Others were sandy, and still others was yellow. The captain, as we designated the dignitary in command of the great vessel, was fully a head taller than any of his companions. He must have stood 13 or 14 feet. The women averaged 10 to 11 feet in height, and their features were especially regular and refined, while their complexion was that of a most delicate tint, heightened by a most healthful, beautiful glow. Both men and women seemed to possess that particular case of manner which we deem a sign of good breeding, and notwithstanding their huge statues, but was nothing about them suggesting any awkwardness. As I was a lad only in my 19th year, I was doubtless looked upon as a true Tom Thumb. My father, 6'3", did not lift the top of his head above the waistline of these people. Each one seemed to vie with the others in extending courtesies and showing us kindness to us, but they all laughed heartily. I remember that when they had to improvise chairs for my father and myself to sit at a table, they were richly attired in a custom peculiar to themselves and very attractive. The men were clothed in handsomely embroidered tunics of silk and satin. Belted at the waist, they wore knee breeches and stockings of a fine texture, while their feet was encased in sandals adorned with gold buckles. We early discovered that gold was one of the most common metals known, and that it was used extensively in their decorations. And strange as it may seem, neither my father nor myself felt the least bit of fear for our safety. We had come into our own. My father said to me, "This is the fulfillment of the tradition told to me by my father and my father's father, and still back to many generations of our race. This is the land beyond the north land." We seemed to make such an impression on the party that we were given specially into the charge of one of the men. His name was Jules Gadelia, and his wife, for the purpose of being educated in their language, and we on part were just as eager to learn as if they were to instruct. At the captain's command, the vessel swung cleverly about and began retracting its course up the river. The machinery was noiseless, and it was very powerful. The banks and trees on either side seemed to rush by. The ship's speed at times surpassed that of any railroad train which I had ever ridden on. And even here in America, it was wonderful. And in the meantime, we had lost sight of the sun's rays, but we found a radiance within emanating from the dull red sun, which had already attracted our attention, now giving out a white light seemingly from a cloud bank far away in the front of us. It dispensed a greater light, I would say far greater than two full moons on the clearest night. In 12 hours, this cloud of whiteness would pass out of sight as if it was eclipsed, and the 12 hours falling corresponding with our night. We early learned that these strange people were worshippers of this great cloud of night. It was called the smoky god of the inner world. The ship was equipped with a mode of illumination which I now presume was electricity. But neither my father nor myself were sufficiently skilled in mechanics to understand whence came the power to operate the ship, or to maintain the soft, beautiful lights that answered the same purpose of our present methods of lighting the streets of our cities, our houses, or our places of business. It must be remembered the time which I write was the autumn of 1829, and we of the outside surface of the earth knew nothing then to speak of concerning electricity. The electrically surcharged or supercharged condition of the air was a constant vitalizer. I never felt better in my life. During the 2 years my father and I stayed on the inside of the earth. To resume a narrative of events, the ship on which we were sailing came to a stop 2 days after we had been taken on board. My father said, as nearly as he could judge, we were directly under Stockholm or London. The city we had reached was called Jeju, signifying a seaport town. The houses were extremely large and beautifully constructed. Now, ladies and gentlemen, what is going on here? This is a wondrous tale. This is something that you can't imagine. imagine. No wonder they thought this man was crazy, and no wonder that they locked him in the insane asylum, and no wonder that he refused to talk about it until on his deathbed. But he never retracted his story. The houses were beautifully constructed and quite uniform in appearance, yet without the sameness. The principal occupant or occupation of the people appeared to be agricultural. The hillsides were covered with vineyards, and the valleys were devoted to the growing of grain. I never saw such a display of gold. It was everywhere. The door casings were inlaid, and the tables were veneered with sheetings of gold. Domes of the public buildings were of gold. It was almost generously in the finishings of the great temples of music. Vegetation grew in lavish abundance, and fruit of all kinds possessed the most delicate flavor that I had never encountered on the surface. Clusters of grapes 4 and 5 feet in length. Each grape as large as an orange, and apples larger than a man's head, typified the wonderful growth of all things on the inside of the earth. The great redwood trees of California would be considered mere underbrush compared with the giant forest trees extending for miles in all directions. And in many directions along the foothills of the mountains, vast herds of cattle were seen during the last days of our travel on the river. We heard much of the city called Eden, but were kept at Jehu, if I were to pronounce it Yahoo, in Hebrew. We were kept in this city called Eden for an entire year. And by the end of what we had learned to speak fairly well the language of this strange race of people, our instructors exhibited a patience that was truly commendable. One day, an envoy from the ruler at Eden came to see us, and for 2 whole days, my father and myself were put through a series of surprising questions. They wished to know from whence we came, what sort of people dwelt without, what God we worshipped, our religious beliefs, the mode of living in our strange land, and 1,000 other things. The compass which we had brought with us attracted especial attention. My father and I commented between ourselves of the fact that the compass still pointed north, although we knew that we had sailed over the curve or over the edge of the Earth's temperature, and while far along southward on the inside surface of the Earth's crust, which according to my father's estimate of his own is about 300 miles in thickness from the inside to the outside. Relatively speaking, it is no thicker than an eggshell, so that there is almost as much surface on the inside as on the outside of the earth. The great luminous clouds, the fiery red mornings and evenings, and during the day giving off a beautiful white light, we call it the smoky god, is seemingly suspended in the center of the great vacuum within the earth and held to its place by an immutable law of gravitation, a repellent atmospheric force, as the case may be. I refer to the known power that draws or repels with equal force in all directions. The base of this electrical cloud of central luminary, the seat of these gods, is dark and non-transparent, save for innumerable small openings, seemingly in the bottom of the great support or altar of the deity upon which the smoky god rests, and the light shining through them in many openings twinkle at night in all their splendor and seem to be stars, as natural as the stars that we saw shining when we were in our home at Stockholm, excepting that they appear larger. The smoky god, therefore, with each daily revolution of the earth, appears to come up in the east and go down in the west the same as does our sun on the external surface. In reality, the people within believe that the smoky God is the throne of Yahweh and is stationary. Oh, hallelujah. The effect of night and day is therefore produced by Earth's daily rotation. I have since discovered that the language of the people in the inner world is much like the language of Sanskrit. Now, after we had given account of ourselves to the emissaries from the central seat of government of the inner continent, and my father had in his crude way drawn maps at the request of the outside surface of the earth, showing the divisions of land and water and given the name of each continent as large islands and oceans, we were taken overland to the city of Eden in a conveyance different from anything that we had ever had in Europe or even here in America. This vehicle was doubtless some electrical device. It was noiseless and ran on a single iron rail in perfect balance. The trip was made at a very high rate of speed. We were carried up hills, down the dales, across the vales and the valleys, and again along the steeps of the mountains, without any apparent attempt of having been made to level the earth, as we have to do with our railroad tracks. On top of each car was high-geared flywheels laying on their sides, which were so automatically adjusted that at the speed of the car increased, the high speed of these flywheels geometrically increased. Our guides explained to us that these revolving fan-like wheels on top of the cars destroyed atmospheric pressure, or what is generally understood by the term of gravitation, and with this force thus destroyed or rendered negative, or negated, the car is as safe from falling to one side or from the other as from the single track, as it were in a vacuum. The flywheels and their rapid revolutions destroying effectively the so-called power of gravitation. The surprise of my father and myself was indescribably when amid the regal magnificence of a spacious hall, we were finally brought before the great high priest, the ruler of over all the land. He was richly robed, and he was much taller than those about him, and could not have been less than 14 or 15 feet in height. The immense room in which we were received seemed finished in solid slabs of gold, thickly studded with jewels of amazing brilliancy. The city of Eden is located in what seems to be a beautiful valley. Yet, in fact, it is on the loftiest mountain plateau of the inner continent, several thousand feet higher than any portion of the surrounding country. It is almost beautiful beyond description. It was a beautiful palace I have never beheld in all of my travels. In this elevated garden, all manner of fruits, vines, shrubs, trees, flowers, they grow in riotous profusion. In this garden, four rivers have their source in a mighty artesian fountain. They divide and flow in four directions. This place is called by inhabitants the navel of the earth, or the beginning, the cradle of the human race. The names of the rivers are the Euphrates, the Pison, the Gihon, and the Hiddekel. And Yahweh planted a garden, as it's described in Genesis 17, and out of the ground made Yahweh to grow every tree that is pleasant inside and good for food. This unexpected, oh my, ladies and gentlemen, I've got to get out of here. I'm already running over time here. You listen to Shepherd's Call, Pastor, but I'm scared away in this. I can't hardly quit. Praise Yahweh. We'll continue at some other time. If we have the time, we'll continue to part four. This is Pastor Buddy, Post Office Box 2284, New Casual, Tennessee, the zip 37824. You can call me at area code 423. 626-2172. The enigma of the earth. What lays within the earth? Is it the lost city of the Garden of Eden? Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Gary, 1-877-289-7439. Brother Paul, 1-800-253-2748. Ladies and gentlemen, I love you, but I got to get out of here. I'll see you.